You are listening to Radio Albion.
Orthodox Nationalists, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It's 1 a.m, Sunday, October 12th, 2025. I've always been a night owl, for whatever reason, since I was a kid. I do my best work at night. This is part two. The Orthodox Nationalist series on Nicolae Popescu. If there is a man who deserves a part two, it's he. This is a man who discovered insulin. He was a functional, he wasn't just a researcher, though. I mean, he was a functional doctor with patients. We discussed some of that last week. If you haven't heard last week, go back to it, please. You know, back in 1984, I discovered Rush for the first time, and they've been my favorite band ever since. I don't know if you've noticed, they have reformed with a female drummer, and I guess a keyboard player or a percussionist or something. Which is a silly, ridiculous cash grab. I'm very depressed about it. There's no new album out or anything. Iron Maiden has a new drummer, some guy. There's also six members. I don't know if any of you have noticed. There's six guys there now. I don't do very well with change. But the Rust thing really has me upset. There's so many great, great players. Very much like Neil, that they could have picked up. No, they picked up her, and solely for virtue signaling purposes, and that alone. So whatever comes out of this, I'm boycotting it 100%. You know, the regime tends to just ruin everything. You ever wonder these musicians like Neil Strauss and whoever this drummer is for Rush, you notice they're always very attractive. How come fat girls never pick up an instrument or have bad skin or bad hair? It's strange. Crazy coincidence, I'm sure. Anyway, it is depressing to me. I would like my friends to also re-up on my Patreon. Subscriptions have fallen off. I understand how things go, but remember, what I write on Patreon is usually what I say in the Daily Nationalist, although in much more detail. Which is another way of saying this is what other nationalists will be saying a month from now. So at least you'll be ahead of the curve in that regard. Now, last week, we dealt with Popescu making a clear connection between a hospital with patients and Romania, in fact, as a patient, as a suffering patient. He had no idea what was to come. He died, you know, during the war. He had no idea how bad things were going to get. But he had a clue. He had an inkling. And being a hospitalist, as well as being a researcher, he connects to his research on what amounts to Talmudic Judaism. That's the pathogen in European and specifically Romanian politics. We left off last time by talking about the hospital. The very concept of a hospital only existed in Christian areas. It did not exist prior to it. When I say a hospital, I mean a building specifically for the sick, with a professional staff to care for them. You had numerous other kinds of sanctuaries, but the hospital as such never existed. Not among the Jews, not among the Egyptians. It only came with Christianity because the concept of murdering the unfit was challenged. Roman and Spartan civilization, if they found a defect in a baby, they would, you know, smash its head or do whatever, so it didn't infect a gene pool in the future. The church came around and said, "We're not doing that anymore." So then we start by saying that this is all held together by charity as a virtue. A virtue, by its very definition, has to be voluntary. It can't be something that you do for attention, or it can't be something that you do for forced to do. And it came straight out of the book of Matthew. "Come, who blessed my father, take your inheritance. For I was thirsty, you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me," etc. And he said, "Lord, when do we ever see you like that?" "Nope. I tell you, when you have done this for the least of your brethren, you did it for me." Now, of course, the key word is brethren. But that's the scriptural core of this. And the way Paulescu interprets it, God knows that as the foundation of all being, the being of being, he knows that there's a certain love that people should have, or that in fact owe to him. But rather than be poured out at him all the time, it should be also poured on in the needy, the sick. And that's an effective, empirical way available to us to manifest our love for God, the creator of the world, the author of our life, to elevate love to the one they cannot reach and has no need for himself of their benefits, since he is infinitely good. It's from this group of sentences that we have the hospitals of St. Fabiola, St. Basil, financed by emperors, princes, and all the wealthy who founded them. And they did nothing but put into practice the precept of what charity truly is. He's very concerned with his own medical profession. But when you read his works, or even think about them, he's not just talking about doctors. He says in his famous book, 1913, he says, "There are some hospitalists, greedy and miserly, who, sacrificing everything for their private clientele, neglect the patients who cannot pay them, and make the hospital visit in a few minutes galloping past their bed." Yes, those problems existed back then too. He says, "And there are others, arrogant, who think that hospitals are made for them and consider the sick as objects of study. They are pleased when they receive an interesting case like Dr. House, on which they'll be able to make a communication to a learned society or publish their observation in a journal. But with the normal poor and sick, well, that's..." The Dr. House comment was not really in the 1913 wording, but, you know, I think you can figure that out. It seems that everything that we worry about in our own healthcare system, even though he's just talking about, not just talking about the hospital, but talking about Romania as a whole, existed 100 years ago. He also says this, There are also hospital doctors who, due to a lack of Christian education, have atrophied their ideal fiber and have fallen into indifference, becoming simply civil servants, drones, who for the largest possible salary do as little as possible. This type of parasitic doctor is swarming everywhere and constitutes a real social plague. Now, Popescu, the founder of the creator of insulin, is pointing at all physicians, all doctors, and he says this: when you enter a hospital, strip yourself of all the passions of greed, pride, cast away laziness, give yourself entirely to the sick, to whom will be grateful if by caring for them you allow you to educate yourself. And if you want to be perfect, reap the fruits that will grow from the seed that I have sown today in your souls. Following the precept of charity, care for the wretched, sick person, not as a man, not as a suffering brother, but as God himself. That is the spirit that should reign in the hospital. That is also the spirit that should reign in any kind of political organization. Nationalism, National Socialism has been disastrous in that regard, fracturous and egocentric. So he goes from talking about the hospital to the various plagues on modern society, Europe on the one hand, Romania on the other. And he talks about three: Islam, Judaism, and Freemasonry. And ultimately, he connects Freemasonry to Judaism. I connected Judaism to Islam. And he spends quite a bit of time, I won't go over it, of course, citing from the Quran, or at the very least the Hadith, saying, for example, in the family, the father's authority is absolute. He has a right to life or death over women and children. Muhammad, however, eases this rigor, especially relative to children. He says, do not kill your children for fear of poverty. Killing children is a great sin. You know, he had to say that. But as for women, we know the story. No one is more anti-feminist than me. I guarantee you, no one on this planet is more anti-feminist than me. But in Islam, in its traditional guise, as Popescu says, he shackles them with the chain of dishonor, polygamy. That is to say, for him. He calls it a degrading scourge that disorganizes the family, the fruit of the union of genital passion with the passion for financial domination. And from there, he says that Islam has thus become the religion of pride and debauchery. Now, let's be clear. The Harem is only, you know, for a tiny handful of very wealthy Muslims. I've discussed the harem, in past lectures. It is not a Xanadu, you know. Had a very different role than what most people think. But to the extent it had that role amongst very, very great nobles, then what he says has some weight. So Muhammad says four wives is enough. Muhammad had 15 at one time, but then he allows him to have an addition of indefinite number of concubines. Some sultans had, you know, a huge number. He says, marry the women you like, 2, 3, 4. If you fear that you cannot support them all, then take only one. You could also marry the handmaid that you have acquired. Women are considered by Muslims either as cattle condemned to abject slavery or as an instrument of pleasure, destined to satisfy the bestial desires of males rotten with vices. Among your wives, this is a quotation from the Quran, among your wives, you will keep those who suit you. You'll separate from those who bore you, and you'll sleep with those who please you. Now, I would recommend you go back, my discussion on the red pill, on the harem. The sexual revolution was already starting to spread its tentacles. The harem wasn't necessarily a sexual institution at all. But we understand what he's trying to say. The founder of Islam then allows his believers to divorce as often as they wish. All the torment of jealousy and having to share the love of a single man with several women. Now, Popescu seems to think that that's solely for the general amusement of the man. That may be the case in some debauched areas. But that's not what a harem is. He says that Muslims, very wealthy Muslims, hide them in windowless prisons, open onto the street. Graves for the living, he said, or cover them with thick veils and leave only their eyes visible. But in order to keep a herd of females in check in the midst of rutting season, as he says, Muslim monsters devise an idea of resorting to males without sexual needs, that is, devoid of genitals. So they forcibly impregnated foreign slaves, made them eunuchs, and used them as harem guards. I think that's a weak part of his argument, but that is part of his argument. I don't think that's Islam today whatsoever, especially in the Shiite side. Remember, the Balkans, Romania is not really Balkans, but very close to it, had fought tooth and nail to throw the Muslims out, and there's a lot of bitterness there, and that's where a lot of this stuff comes from, so... I think he's exaggerating, but I understand what he means. However, it's a different story when he talks about the religion as essentially a state. There is no distinction between the state and the Muslim religion. In the Arab nation, power is absolute. Unbridled passion to change it to despotism, ferocious tyranny. And he claims it reigns in all Muslim countries. Remember, too, as this is being written, Armenians and Greeks are being persecuted all over the place. Muhammad constantly merges both civil and religious authorities. The head of state is a cleric, the cleric's the head of state. Caliphs and sultans are, at the same time, kings and pontiffs. There's no separation, as there is in everything else. In Orthodoxy or Catholicism. He concludes by saying, this fact is an indisputable sign that Muhammad established a mere national institution and not, as he claimed, a universal religion. Now, if you go back many years, I've spoken of this issue. Again, I think a lot of this is exaggerated, but I wanted to mention it. But the Sultan has the right of life and death over all his subjects in theory, and then claims that the massacre of the Armenians, now this was written in 1913, so they had a lot more to come here. This has been going on for a while. A massacre that hadn't been seen since the French Revolution, he says, because he had the power of life or death. This is prior to the Young Turks Revolution. Then he goes on, you know, like what the neocons say, kill the infidels whenever you find them and all that stuff. Kill the wicked, you could put an end to the rebellion. There'll be no other law in the world than the love of God, etc., etc., etc. Talks about jihad, you know. But again, you have to understand the context in which this is done. And the wars which have just been fought. It is true that the once thriving civilizations of North Africa and Asia have been lost forever. Islam swept over them as the colonial power. But many peoples, Romanians, Greeks, Serbs, Bulgarians, who were able to escape with their lives, were reborn from the ashes and quickly, in a few years, took on a new lease on life and culture. Everywhere in its path, Mohammedism and his warrior Islam sowed, along with devastation, inertia, sleep, and death. He also argues that slavery is justified. He says that slavery is indeed another plague, most hideous, spread by this terrible calamity that is Islam. Popescu writes, I'm going to quote him directly here, Romanian history will sacredly preserve the memory of the thousands of young girls, true virgin martyrs, kidnapped from grieving families in order to fill the harems and brothels of Islam. She will not forget the thousands of boys, Montenegrins, Moldavians, whom the Muslims took into slavery to Istanbul to be trained and thus introduced to the body of the Janissary. Such a claim, which the Turks even wanted to introduce into a treaty, outraged the voivode Vlad the Impaler and made him decide to take up arms, thus causing the country to endure all the horrors of that war. To a great extent, it's hard to argue with that. The slave trade was Judaic. But remember, someone like Popescu, as brilliant as he was, didn't have access to the information that we have today. The information that we have today whatsoever. The other thing he says that's poisonous, moral rot, he says, the law of talion. Man for man, eye for an eye, nose for nose, ear for ear, tooth for tooth, wound for wound. Retaliation is prescribed for you in murder, free for free, slave for slave. Retaliation is also prescribed for you in order to murder, etc. Even insults. Someone insults you, you insult them back. Which, of course, is not the Christian way at all. Muhammad makes revenge a duty. It's a sacred order. The crux of his argument is that Orthodoxy alone, Christianity alone, had the capacity to be a universal religion. Judaism, of course, could never be universal by its very definition. And Islam was too closely tied to the Arabic language. The conditions for a true, you know, universal truth, they don't exist in either Islam or in Judaism. Not to mention they're both based on many myths and stories. I mean, one is based on the code of the Arab nation, the other the code of the Jewish nation. Now, I know some of that is exaggerated, some of that is very harsh, but if you go back, I don't remember, it's been so long ago, I talked about the Jewish origins of Islam. I've uncovered all kinds of things that no one else had mentioned before. I can't remember it off the top of my head now. To flesh that out, please go to that. I don't know if you're going to find it anywhere else. Then he moves to the Talmud. Now, this is far more important to us. It's interesting. He says, in the family, the Talmud gives the Jew absolute power over the Jewess. In the Babylonian Talmud, it says so explicitly. It says he could treat her as Sodom. And if she complains, the Hachams will answer her, we can't come to your aid, for the law has given you over to your husband. That's from the book of the Sanhedrin. And actually, in the writing here, I have the full citations. The Talmud also accepts polygamy. The king cannot marry more than 18 women. The law says that he can take more, only he must not take women capable of corrupting him. Now, that's from the Jerusalem version of the Talmud. Also from the book of the Sanhedrin, page 220 in the Schwab edition. Now, I've mentioned this before, but if a married Jew has sex with a Gentile woman, it's not adultery, it's bestiality. It's never punished as adultery in the strictest sense. The phrase is, among the naked, there is no marriage. In other words, among the savages, there is no marriage. Non-Jewish marriages bring with them no obligations. Their lives are bound like those of horses. and contrary to all Christian morality. Talmudic legislation strongly recognizes and supports the institution of slavery, just like Islam does. Zadok Khan, and his secondary source on the he's citing the Jerusalem Talmud, says the Talmud, like Ross, strips the slave of all personality and assimilates him to a simple property. The Mosaic Constitution recognizes two kinds of slaves who have neither the same rights nor the same position, the Jewish slave and the foreign slave. This distinction is formal in the Bible, but it emerges with more precision in the Talmud. The Talmud, and taken to its extreme, gives the Jews a right of absolute domination over everything that is not Jewish, over all of humanity. Now, of course, practically speaking, that can't happen. But that's not for any moral concern. We all know that we are beasts. Gentiles are nothing but animals. Descendants of Abraham, the Lord said to you, you are men. Well, the other peoples of the world are not made up of men, but of beasts. It's a Babylonian Talmud, Baba Mitzia. Jews are men, while the Gentiles are pigs. Non-Jews are dogs and donkeys. The Babylonian Talmud, Barachot, specifically that book. That means, like any slave society, the Goyim, being beasts, given by God over to the Jews, have over them the right of life and death. The Jews have over them the right of life and death, that power. And therefore they can be exploited mercilessly, without the slightest pang of conscience. Again, Talmud, as men rule over the animals, so the Jews must rule over the other nations of the earth. The Messiah will give the empire of the world to Jews, whom all the peoples will serve and obey. That's from Babylonian Talmud, also from the Sanhedrin, page folio 88. Even Maimonides, Irania, they all said the same thing. They speak of the universal dominion of the Jews. Talmud says in the Sanhedrin, wherever the Jews settle, they must become masters. And until they obtain eternal domination, they must consider themselves exiles and prisoners. Even when they come to govern the cities, if they don't rule them all, they will not cease to cry, alas, and horror. And of course, we have heard that many times. Now, he goes on to quote a contemporary Jew, Bernard Lazar, especially in his book, Antisemitism. I only have here the 1994 edition, but it's 100 years older than that. He was actually a 19th century figure. He says, without Talmudic law, without Israel practicing it, the world would cease to exist. God would cause it to return to nothingness. The world would not know happiness until it has submitted to the universal empire of this law, that is, the empire of the Jews. Now, this is prior, he's writing this prior to the foundation of the State of Israel. God seems to be secondary in these things. God has deposited whatever we need in the Jews, so then he becomes unnecessary. Other people then are placed below the Jews. They have no right except through mercy, divine generosity, or, more importantly, when you can't seem to be too harsh, people will start hating you, and you can't have that. So then he moves to more or less contemporary statistics. We're talking about Romania as a sick patient. He just talked to you about the pathology or the history of this problem. You know, the development of this virus. And what he says is pretty much what we know, especially at the time. And I've excellent firsthand sources here. Industry, especially commerce in the cities of Romania, have passed entirely into the hands of the Jews. Again, this is written in 1913. And really, very quickly, and only in a few years. He uses the statistics from the city of Yassi in 1908. I mean, the statistics are even more shocking than I thought. Romanian Jews have 5,570 in that field, while Romanian craftsmen are only not even 2,000. Remember, the Jew is aided by the Kahal. The Kahal didn't really exist at the time, but the mentality of the Kahal certainly did exist. He says, while poor Romanians have no connection with each other and enjoy no support, are absolutely disarmed in the competitive struggle and are easily eliminated by their rivals. And we're not even talking about the larger concerns, which, despite the enormous sacrifices of the state, and especially of consumers, is entirely Jewish. It's extremely powerful. It's almost like the cells in the body have stopped communicating. The synapses in the brain have stopped communicating. Now, when you get into commerce, it becomes absurd. This is from the General Report of the Chamber of Commerce and Industry in Yassi, 1908. In 1908, there were 121 Romanian merchants. The Jews had 1,742. And for example, they had 344 pub owners, compared with only 51. In the entire city, you had exactly one Romanian baker. 80 were Jews. And such proportions were found in the cities of Moldova and many in Wallachia that were found all over Europe at the time. The report of the Chamber of Commerce and Industry from 1906 says in the city of Petrișani, out of 133 pubs, only 6 belong to Romanians. In Dorohoi, out of 74 pubs, barely 4 are run by Romanians. And that proportion is seen all over their area. The war of 1877, the Scani Street in Bucharest was entirely occupied by Romanian merchants. 15 years later, that have been taken over entirely by Jews. Now, there are very few Romanians there whatsoever. The complete destruction accomplished in a short time that had to be plotted, executed by a master hand with financial means, prepared in advance and coming from abroad, at least. Such a result could not have been achieved by a mob or unconscious purpose or something, but by a disciplined, thoughtful, well-equipped troop, having abundant capital, rushing to the attack, pursuing the determined target. This is the army of organized Jewry, or the Kahal. This is why people hated them. There's a lot of reasons, but this is a huge reason. In the countryside, the report on the economic state of the countries of Petrișani, Dorohoi, and Sosieva for the year 1906, report of the Chamber of Commerce and Industry. That's 1906. Again, very depressing figures. Romanians completely control portion of Romanian merchants, which does not even reach 25%, is high, because Romanians still keep almost all the trade in alcoholic beverages in villages, which by law, foreigners cannot open taverns. However, Jews always find a way to break it, a way around the law, and as soon as they reach their villages, and the villagers, I should say, they sneak in, they're able to enter, they do not delay in selling alcohol secretly. If you've been following our talk on Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together, we spent a lot of time on the hatred that's engendered by Jewish pub ownership or alcohol distillery and distribution in Russia. Romanians, by 1913, were disappearing from cities and villages in the face of the Jews. They had taken their livelihood, deprived them of their daily bread, and poisoned them, but not the alcoholic beverages are one thing, but they were adulterated. They weren't the same. They cut corners, in other words. And Yassi in 1839, the number there If you want to compare it with 1909, used to be 264 Romanians owned pubs in 1839, 51 in 1909. Fisheries went from 58 to zero. And all other fields have very similar numbers. Romanians, to some extent, were forced against their will to leave the trade and commerce. It was the incapacity and especially dishonesty of the upper classes, who were unable to defend their interests. Now, back then, you actually had governments that worried about this kind of thing. And this was from the Administrative Council of Moldova, addressed to the prince. This is May 31st, 1838. The finance department, this number 8.621, reported to the council that it constantly receives complaints from the guilds and the chief Starots or elder, the exposure of the troubles of the Romanians suffer from the Jews, the monopolized trade and businesses. They've seized the largest part of the profits. Following the change of clothing, according to Western form, I wanted Christian tailors to get used to making European costumes, but the Jews did not want to tolerate them. We demand that Jews who use the rights of the guilds be subject to the same tax as the guilds. Following the change of clothing, meaning that the laws had been liberalized. The Jews didn't have to. I mean, they usually did anyway. Assimilation was something that would support the Jews, not oppose them. Their distinctive clothing was not necessary, at least legally, after 1838. And this really comes from Prince Mihail Sturdza, who, like so many European rulers, brought in Jews, thinking that they were just, you know, just like everyone else. And that any anti-Jewish idea was just jealousy. Now, we've spoken about why the Jews dominate these fields. Is it out of any superiority? First of all, they break all the traditional rules. They're purely Machiavellian. They do things like they advertise and all these illegal things. We're not, you know, advertising, trying to get customers away from another place was out of the question years ago. Whatever it took, which was something absolutely out of the question, even in such a late date as the late 19th century. The debt that they held, they were able to take so much in their fire sales, not to mention smuggling, which they were very good at, especially in the Russian Empire. The same that letter, from the Administrative Council of Moldova, they say, you know, at one point they had they allegedly come from a Galicia, whatever, a Russian Poland, with absolutely nothing. Today they own 31% of urban land and property in Moldova. And this is the case everywhere. In Dorohoy, Jews have houses worth 5,500,000 lei. The Romanians have them for about 2.8 million. In Falicente, the proportion is 7 million to 5 million. In Mehaliente, it's 1,100,000 for the Romanian, for the Jew, well, sorry, 1,100,000 for the Jews, 200,000. Absolute minimum for the Romanians. And that was according to the Ministry of Finance at the time. Which means that having money, they lent it at enormous interest rates to the unfortunate Romanians, for which any loan meant ruin. They function no different than any kind of mafia organization in the U.S. does. Poor peasant, in order to pay for a hat that sells for 6 lei, to a Jew, he had to sell a pair of oxen to buy it. But the Jew's trade par excellence, his element, his primordial need, the unlimited field of the dreams of the future power, the comforted hope, the hidden revenge against the Christians. That's the moneylender stall. That's where usury comes from. It's as much political as anything else. The creation of cartels and trusts of all kinds and the endless organization. The hundreds of Jewish organizations, even if there are just a handful of Jews in an area, you end up having 13 organizations. And they drive the price up. For example, Romanians pay a huge price for sugar, almost double what we get in Bulgaria. Bread also has been, the price has been driven up for this very same reason. Romania is very fertile, but it's importing its food? We say that for the Soviet Union. Now, Bolescu also says, beyond all that, he says there are essentially three social systems that derive from Freemasonry. Freemasonry is something that he considers to be Judaic at its root. He says the Jews created Freemasonry, the help which they conceived the French Revolution. Now, there may be something to that. It certainly was Judaized as time went on. Although we have to admit, the agenda was exactly the same. Destroy the monarchy. To seize the wealth of the country. To damage the image and the wealth of the Church of Rome in France. That didn't last, even after the French Revolution. The Talmudic dream was compromised. Israel had not become, and I say Israel, I'm using that in quotes, of course, had not become, as she hoped, the master of humanity, the owner of the earth. Nor had it succeeded in strangling its mortal enemy, which was the Church of Rome at the time. So then the idea develops. Make all nations work for their own ruin and destruction. Humanity, which for God knows how many centuries, receives a Christian education and intellectual and material development, unprecedented until now, of course. But these economic systems diverted that, rendering everything as a matter of material and how it's divided. So what's put in their place, if the revolutions are a false liberalism, or actually I think it's just liberalism, and a pseudo-socialism, which may well be true, a pseudo-socialism called Marxism. And then maybe you could add anarchism. It kind of, you know, it's its poisonous tail. It's the third entity. Now, the initial revolutions in France and throughout the 19th century, they were Masonic. They were liberal. They were aimed at the bourgeoisie. But then that had been adopted by most of the governments, you know, except for Russia, of course, throughout the 19th century. The followers of that system, even in that moderate bourgeois model, they want to destroy the monarchy, first and foremost, no matter what. Because monarchs are the natural defenders of the nations against the enterprises of the oligarchs, the Jews. They replace them by republics. And republics, people who run for office can be easily bought or intimidated. Liberals want to give, of course, the riches of the Christian countries to themselves, ultimately making proletarians out of them through a kind of slavery. Man no longer works except for the benefit of Israel. And the Freemasonic liberals also want, even before all else, to banish Christianity from the education of all nations. Bernard Lazada, who I've quoted many times, both in the Solzhenitsyn series as well as just now, and his work Anti-Semitism. He says, in the history of modern liberalism in Germany and Austria and France and Italy, the Jew has played a great part. Liberalism went hand in hand with the anti-clericalism, and the Jew was, of course, anti-clerical. He pushed the Kulturkampf in Germany, and was approved the Ferry Laws, which I mentioned last week, of religious persecution in France. This is how the Jews were able to de-Christianize Europe. If you go back to my work on Karl Marx's The Jewish Question, this is how they made Jews out of Christians. At the very core of that book. But Bernard Lazar also says, well, we'll get to him in a minute. Wait a minute. The second is Jewish socialism. Lazar will have something to say about that. It's pseudo-socialism, though. Socialism has been around a lot longer than Karl Marx. Essentially, it wants to make use of the people's brought into misery. It made the proletarians created by liberalism. That's its target. To take from the Goyim what's left, especially the land, which the liberal system couldn't completely seize, hand it over. This is the very nature of central planning. Lazada, again, he says, as for the Socialist Party, the Jews contributed with power to its organization, Marx and LaSalle in Germany, Aaron Lieberman and Alder in Austria, Adolfo Gianu Guerra in Romania, Gompers Khan Line in the U.S., all were, still are the directors, initiators of this party. And he cites many more in his book. James Cohen in Denmark, Neumeier in Austria, Freiburg, Loeb, Haltmeier, Lazada, Levi, Armin Levi in France, Singer, Bernstein, Leo Frankel in Germany, Cohen in England, Cohen in Belgium, among many others. Thus, the prophecies of the Talmud will be fulfilled. But that second stage, the socialist stage, is the central planning stage, to suppress every trace of Christianity. It's the seal that marks socialism. It's a terror against Christians. If you want to know whether a doctrine is Jewish or not, you have to look for whether or not it is directed against the church. Let me quote Lazada one more time. The Jews gave weapons to those who fought Christianity, and in the assaults in the church, they always found themselves. Also, they brought about the revolution. They were in the century among the most ardent supporters of the liberal, socialist, revolutionary parties, which they supported with their great capital. Notice that he's writing in a book about the causes of anti-Semitism, and I'm not quite sure he realizes that these are all causes of anti-Semitism, or anti, you know, they're anti-Jewish. I don't like Semite. I only use it for the sake of, it's familiar, it's easy, everyone uses it. I hate it because it, you know, they're Khazars. Again, he wrote this many, many years ago, long before anything else. Long before the Soviet Union was created, long before even World War I. He had no idea how right he really was when he wrote this. The Jewish presence in these groups were just starting to make themselves known. USSR was formed a few years later. That list of names grew far longer. That list of names became absurdly long. Now, anarchism is something generally not worth talking about, because it's not a system you can actually live. If government were to disappear, a strongman would take over, either at one level or another. I don't know, it could be the most powerful drug dealer or whoever it is. No different than what happened in Russia in the early 1990s. There wouldn't be freedom for people. In the abstract, local strongmen would take power because there's always already people stronger than others before the state country, the government go away. It's not in a vacuum. But it just serves as a tool. It appeals to the dregs of society. I mean, real prisoners. You know, this is why the prisons are always opened during these leftist revolutions. And they really, it's really only used to kill those who resist, those who don't allow, you know, those who resist the other systems. today is found in Antifa. That's exactly what Antifa is. They almost all claim to be anarchists. You know, I fought Antifa in the street many times over the years. I'm very proud to say. They've gotten smaller. They've gotten more feminized as the years have gone on. Far less healthy than I remember many, many decades ago. Nevertheless, that's what anarchism is. Really, there's not much more. But the connections that exist amongst liberalism, Freemasonry, socialism, anarchism, that should pretty much be clear. Now, again, I say this in such a way because he's writing this in 1913. The literature on this topic was just starting to get going. You had a few things after the French Revolution, 1848, a few works on royalism. After 1848, 1871. But the things that we have known and systematized now were not known. And he's just giving us the very general outline here. The Congress of the Lodges of the Center that was held in Ghent in 1894 voted to move towards promoting collective property. They've gone beyond the bourgeois concerns. Most of the Parisian lodges became socialists in the 19th century. The departmental lodges followed on the path. In the convention of 1900, many declared that only in socialism, and specifically in socialism, applied in its entirety, that's the key, the social question. It's a logical conclusion and the only consistent crowning of the ideas of solidarity of universal masonry. Therefore, these two systems, liberalism and socialism, which many people think are opposed, are really part of the Masonic and Judaic bloc. And they ultimately have their root in both the Talmud and the Kabbalah. Now, weeks ago, we talked about Karl Marx's The Jewish Question, which I got a tremendous response for. And people really loved it. But capitalism and liberalism are absolutely necessary in order for socialism to develop. There has to be an accumulation phase there. Therefore, free trade is absolutely necessary for, among other things, to destroy national loyalties and, of course, put Jews in positions of power. There's a Jew who, way back when, 19th century, he used a pseudonym, Constantine Dobrogianu Gera. His real name was Solomon Katz. He wrote several works at the time. And let me quote just one section here. A social epoch prepares the necessary conditions of existence for the following epoch. Thus, the feudal arranges these conditions for the bourgeois, and this in turn arranges them for the socialist one. It follows that a society cannot, during its life, create its own evolution, different from that which results from historical development. It can't skip over the capitalist era. Well, that's Marxism 101, of course. I'm not sure Marx had really penetrated most people at the time, including intellectuals. But skipping over capitalism, well, that's something that Pol Pot was a very... It's sort of a Maoist idea. If you look at his Wikipedia page, it is hilarious because it says that he is both a Marxist and an entrepreneur. Like it's normal. He said something else. He said, the transformation of a notable part of a large property into a small property, and consequently the change of the agricultural proletarians into small owners, would be for a capitalist country a prejudicial event from an economic point of view. For us, however, this metamorphosis would constitute a useful fact, for it would be a revolutionary fact. How could the same social fact produce in our country and in an advanced capitalist society not only different, but even diametrically opposed results? We have not left the medieval era and must enter the capitalist, that is, a liberal era. while Western countries are beginning to emerge in the capitalist period, they're already on the socialist path. Nowhere do the Leninists promote small plots for farmers or anything, unless they're going to quickly take them away. That they want to artificially just plop in a very rapid capitalist phase to make Marxism work out. And it's funny how, you know, Karl Marx would be on and on about the militarist he was against Russia during the Crimean War, opposed to all the anti-war movements, supporting free trade. So he says, I'm talking about the same guy, Katz, who was a theoretician and sort of a very bad theoretician of Marxism in Romania, and a wealthy Jew, of course. The suppression of neo-serfdom will remedy the miseries of the current regime. This transformation of our agrarian life will bring with it the miseries and troubles of the capitalist regime, among other things, the proletarianization of a good part of the peasantry. But the time will come when another regime will heal all the wounds caused by the previous one. And this regime will be the socialist one, which will come about without a doubt. And no one should have the slightest doubt about it. Now, a proletariat or a proletarian doesn't own anything. Those farmers, those people who owned a small plot of land, will lose it. Either through debt or through violence or whatever. The rest of the family then becomes proletarianized. The only reason that Marx and the far left cared about the proletariat, the only reason is because given their social status of owning nothing, of having nothing, of being far from their home in the village, coming across all these new vices, they usually were there alone. You know, just because it was seasonal. All these vices, everything from prostitution to liquor to everything else. Their moral code is going to fall away. The Christian code is going to fall away. That's exactly our target. Because a proletarian doesn't own anything. That's the definition of a proletarian. You can't have anything. But the Masons were not unclear about this. The delegates of the Council of the Order in 1899 stated that the ideal of Freemasonry is to create, through positive philosophy, a link between socialists and even anarchists with the bourgeoisie. People like Francisco Ferrer, Spanish anarchist involved in the attempt to assassinate King Alfonso XIII, once he became this so-called free thinker, which means a leftist, he immediately was initiated into the Masonic Lodge, Verdad, in Barcelona, 146, in the Grand Orient. He took the symbolic name Brother Quiero, and he reached the 32nd degree, which by that point was Luciferian. Now Lazar, on the other hand, Lazarus says, Russian Jews must occupy a special place in socialism, and alongside the nihilistic Israeli students, doctors, and lawyers, there must be placed the considerable mass of refugee workers who have founded in London and New York important working-class agglomerations, centers of socialist and even anarchist communist propaganda. Well, the Jew is to be the efficient cause of these systems. They certainly don't serve the cause of the underclass whatsoever. There's only the party. There's only the regime. He thinks that Romanians are a little bit special, though. He says, you know, unlike many other young people who went abroad to study upon liberation did not come back liberals, Republicans, Masons. Romanians were a little different. They didn't let themselves be pulled in by the Jews. The French, Austrian, Italian, Russian, different story. The Romania was a little different in that regard. There was a very strong nationalism there. And it's true that the nationalist movement had a far greater hold in Romania than it did elsewhere. It had tremendous organization, which it did not have in Russia, unfortunately. We're talking about the ending of the two bloody Balkan Wars. The last one included the Romanians. A tremendous amount of death and dislocation. But now, we take it back to the beginning. Charity. What was the point of all of this? Charity is a love of God poured on men, which forms a sublime, central aspect of Christian morality. It is unknown in the Talmud. A charitable man does not exist for those in Judah. There can be no question of charity in Israel. That comes straight from Bernard Lazar, from his Anti-Semitism, page 310. They take care of each other, but not in general. They always maintain that savage hatred of those who were not Jews, and especially and specifically against Christians. We know what the Talmud says here. You can't pity an idolater. When you see him perishing or drowning in a river, when he's about to die, you must not save him. That comes straight from Maimonides. If a goy is found near a well, you should throw him into it. If there's a ladder, you should pull it out. You should cover the entrance of the well with a stone, saying, I am doing this so that my cattle won't fall in. Babylonian Talmud, about Azada. If you pull a naked man out of this pit, you save an idolater. Again, same place. That's just the beginning. I mean, I could string out these. You know, everyone just quotes the same list of Talmudic quotes. I hate them. You know, it's just cliches, and I hate cliches. No. You know, there's a lot more in the Talmud. The only thing you need to condemn modern Jewry is Jewry, is their sources. Pulescu was one of the first in the 20th century to understand the role of these institutions, their interconnections in Romania and in Europe at the time. But he saw it as a doctor. He did not see it as a political scientist. He saw it always as white blood cells going after the pathogen. Sometimes white blood cells don't recognize cancer as a pathogen, so they don't do anything. How do you get that to happen socially? Well, the Jews have already done that. What we take for granted today is outrageous. We started with charity. We end with charity. And this is the man who was one of the greatest doctors, greatest medical minds of Romanian history. He could not be ignored. You can't, even liberals say that, yes, he discovered the formula first. He should have gotten the Nobel Prize. He discovered it. Although, frankly, I think we know that diabetes is easily curable. Just get rid of all carbs, all of them. We're doing it with our dog right now. He's down to a minimal insulin injection, and he's doing wonderfully. All carbs have to be knocked out and be consistent on that. Nevertheless, if anyone is a great man, it is Nicolae Pulescu. Romanians have every reason to be proud of him, not just as a doctor, but as a man who refused to be cowed by the rich and the powerful, and to see this kind of thing, to understand the interconnections between Marxists, the socialists, the Freemasons, all the stuff that sounds crazy to your average normie. Because your average normie has no access to any of this. He lives in a sanitized and censored world We do not. We feel and see everything. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.